Hello and welcome to this week's edition of A Hard Place with me, Dominic Searle. A Hard Place is a space to talk about the issues that directly or indirectly affect your everyday lives, as seen from a Gibraltar perspective. Well, I'm with my regular guest, the former Labour MP, current Lib Dem member and well-known Freeman of the City of Gibraltar, Andrew McKilney. Andrew, welcome to the Washroom Studios in 2026. We delayed doing the podcast a couple of days for different reasons, and every day we've delayed, something's happened. So we've had tremendous things happening in terms of Trump plucking Maduro out of Venezuela. Putin seems to still be up to his tricks with Ukraine, although we seem to get some more positive noises hopefully coming towards the idea of a solution. Zelensky says maybe in the next 6 months there'll be something more solid. And then we've had the dramatic episode with the Americans, with British help, landing on a tanker, something that is not unfamiliar to Gibraltar. I remember a few years ago we had an incident with a tanker, Iranian fuel. So, I mean, you wonder what's happening on top of all that. Greenland, I mean, is Donald Trump, do you think, there's an expression in Spanish called mareando la perdiz, which means to dizzy the partridge before basically you shoot it, and so that people never know quite what he's going to do. He says one minute it's all about the homeland issues, it's all domestic, and then the next thing is he's all over the place talking about Greenland, getting everyone in a panic. Is this a sort of, the apprentice master TV program style running the world?
Well, I'm not a person who rushes to question people's abilities and their cognizance, but I am worried about Trump. It does seem to me he's kind of lost it, even from his point of view. I can understand promoting the Monroe Doctrine, United States leads and Western Hemisphere and the need for him to defend the United States. It's his primary duty as President of the United States to defend the country. And I can understand the need for both America and the rest of NATO to be assured that there's a proper profile and presence in Greenland. But the idea of sequestering it, of seizing it, and even of buying it, it seems to me to be potty from the point of view of the United States. It's lost all credibility. And if I am wrong, and he really does mean it, and he's thought it through, his planning of this, it does mean the end of NATO, which a week or two ago, if we would never have contemplated that being the gravity of the situation.
But I mean, isn't it just so that people understand? I mean, Americans have a base on Greenland. I don't think anyone doubts that if they wanted to triple it, quadruple it, or whatever, they could do so with support and help and whatever. It's not like they're cramming people out. I mean, it's a huge place, and the people, it's a 56, it's double the population, or less than double the population of Gibraltar. Massive piece of land. So, in friendship, with the right economic engagement, it seems to me that he could be totally in control of Greenland de facto. Could this actually be something to do with the broader issue of popularity? Because on the one hand, he probably would love to finish in a couple of years. He's talked about 3 years to solve the Greenland issue, maybe to say, look, I've taken over the Western Hemisphere. It's America from top to bottom. I mean, Canada must be sort of feeling pretty uneasy. And at the same time, what we've seen over the last 6 months, particularly, I think, looking at a distance, is, you've had Zoran Mumdani come into New York. You're seeing Gavin Newsom as a potential Democratic president. I mean, it looks like the opposition there, the Democrats, are coming in with youth, energy, and a certain amount of ground support. I mean, a small sample that you'll know means something to me, but when I was in Washington before Trump got in a couple of years ago, we went to the Kennedy Center. Now, overnight, a couple of months ago, he sent a team round. It's now called the Trump Kennedy Center. And groups of...
Which, those of us, incidentally, who remember President Kennedy, find it very offensive. For all his deficiencies, we still hold President Kennedy in high regard, who prevented, along with Khrushchev, nuclear war in 62.
That's right. Well, the jazz group that was going to play on New Year's Eve pulled out, and then somebody was threatening $1 million lawsuit and so forth. Then a more important group, which is a whole set of veteran jazz musicians, people who played with the big names like Miles Davis and John Coltrane, they're called the Cookers, and they perform in the UK, all over Europe, huge names in the jazz world, pulled back and said, we can't perform there. And the only sort of statement they made about it is that their background was, you know, the passage through slavery, the passage in all the difficulties of American life and so forth. So you've got Trump has got a problem, because I think, you know, MAGA doesn't expect him to be doing all this sort of world politics, does it?
No, I think that his support will not crumble away, but will be hard very soon, because mainstream United States conservatives, if I can put it that way, the people like Bob Dole, the Bushes, and the McCain, that kind of character, they, one, believe in NATO, they believe in the rule of law, and will also recognise that Denmark, albeit small, has been a proud and dedicated supporter of the NATO alliance, served alongside American service men and women in Afghanistan, and we'll see this as a sort of an unnecessary fight. I think we should this week be worried about that in particular, but also this so-called revising the Monroe Doctrine. It is very worrying, for not just for Greenland, but also for people in Cuba, Colombia, and small jurisdictions like the Falkland Islands, and dare I say, even those of us who are proud to be associated with the wonderful jurisdiction of Gibraltar, should begin to get a bit anxious about. One doesn't want to over-exaggerate this, but if NATO collapsed, there wouldn't be constraints upon a right-wing Spanish government to the same extent there are now. I mean, even though we are not in the European Union, there's a presumption that these states will follow the rule of law.
But don't you think that to some extent he's chosen to do things where we criticise the method, we're not necessarily upset with the outcome? In other words, if you start with, say, those drugs, couriers coming out of Venezuela, which are known to be causing enormous problems. I mean, the world's half of the Western, youth problem is coming from lots of drugs, bad drugs, cheaper drugs, you know, all these sorts of things. So there's an element of where, you know, it almost looks like the ends justifies the means. Maduro wasn't popular with anybody. I mean, even the Spaniards who are sort of have been critical of the means, and nonetheless, they never recognized the Maduro government. They weren't impressed by it. They didn't support it. So you've got him actually trying to choose things where he can get away with it to some extent, because the public will say deep down, maybe he's right.
Well, I'm not sure the public will on this occasion. I don't know if what your view is on this as a newspaper man, Dominic, but it would seem to me that in the United Kingdom and other comparable democracies, there is a mainstream public opinion thinks that this was abhorrent. It broke international law and compounds our international problems, particularly it gives legitimacy to Putin taking a slice out of Ukraine. And it's an invitation to the People's Republic of China to move on Taiwan, just to name two examples of where this situation is aggravated.
hasn't Europe, I mean, you know, we've seen the terrible things that happen in Switzerland, but we know what happens all over the place when you follow the news. Europe has been a little bit like, people who know that there are fire risks or dangers or different things, and you know, they do nothing about them. They don't clear from potholes in the road. And so you can get to a stage where you're sitting back with the sort of principles and lots of good debate and high-sounding statements. But Europe hasn't been actually investing in... I mean, I don't know about you, but it always worried me that the first thing that happened after the Cold War sort of ended and Berlin Wall came down was masses of super-wealthy Russians, asset-stripping Russia, coming out, going to places like the UK and investing in Knightsbridge and I don't know where. And we all sat back because we were taking the dollars. And,
yes,
and instead of building, exactly, instead of rebuilding the country there. So, I mean, there's an element of complacency that has caught up with us. And I think, you know, a lot of people are saying it, and very significant people, particularly military people, we've got to do something about it now. We've got to move now. It's not the time to sit, you know, sort of pussyfooting about it.
Yes, but I think that the war on drugs, as serious as it is and how it should be, certainly prosecuted by the big states, democratic states, using their law enforcement agencies, that should happen. But I think in relation to Venezuela, it's an excuse. It's an excuse to seize back what Trump perceives as the ownership of the oil installations and industry and other raw materials. I think that's the primary objective. When I asked you about, as a newspaper man, I think that he has united mainstream politicians in Western Europe, and most of the newspapers, mainstream newspapers, including ones who are on the conservative right, think that this is, reckless decision to do, hasn't been thought through, ramifications, knocking on effects, and they also believe in the rule of law, which you can't preach to Putin and others on a selective basis.
Well, before we sound like the Skibbereen Eagle, the small newspaper in Baltimore, Cork Island, which I think in 1890s issued a warning to the Tsar, let's turn closer to home. Can we sort of take a optimism back out from that suitcase under the bed, do you think, in the coming year? I mean, you've got a poll that says that in May, anything could happen. Farage is likely to win a lot of seats. It's quite clear that Starmer has started the year trying to prepare for that and say, look, this is the year that things are going to turn around, that what we've invested in an effort is going to show itself. I mean, what's going to happen in the UK? Are we setting ourselves for a change of prime minister?
Well, leading on from our last discussion a few moments ago, I just think that Starmer and therefore the British government have been somewhat supine to the United States and Donald Trump. We don't know, for instance, if the people who were seized on the oil ships are incarcerated or in detention in United Kingdom RAF bases. Whatever happens, I think that he takes another blow, and so does the leader of the Conservative Party, Badenoch. They're further diminished in the electorate's eyes by their reactions or lack of clear, clarified response to President Trump. But moving on to the domestic situation, the opinion polls are showing that the Labour and the Conservative Party are almost finished. And I think if you scratch the surface, you'll find that in terms of activists, so not just nominal party members, but people who actually deliver leaflets, knock on doors, and support rallies and things such as that, they've hemorrhaged from Conservative and Labour parties, particularly the Conservative Party. All the indication is that the Reform Party is going to do extraordinarily well, which I regret. But I think I have to be realistic that they are pressing the right buttons at the moment. What person who's having a good press, as it were, is Davey of the Liberal Democrats, which I personally welcome. But I've been involved in politics since 1962-63, when I was a young schoolboy. I was delivering leaflets, elections and so on. I've never known a situation where the main parties are so being dismissed by the electorate. Every week I look at the by-elections up and down the country, which are held on Thursdays. It's worth examining on Friday mornings to see what overnight has been the results. And overwhelmingly, they are wins by the Reform Party, particularly but not exclusively against the Conservatives. And the Liberal Democrats have done very well.
Are you thinking that by the time we get to the next general election, which is still some years to go, I mean about 3 years, that we might still have a Labour stroke Lib Dem coalition or something like that? Do you think that's a more likely outcome than a solid win by anyone?
Well, the latest figures, which I discussed with you when we had a conversation last week, show Reform are targeted to get 277 seats, Conservatives 99, Labour 107, and the Liberal Democrats more or less holding their own at 68. It's a snapshot of the position now, and I can't see anything changing other than the crisis for the two main parties deepens. Looking ahead to the general election, a long way off, I assume, I think that what is a great possibility is a coalition government being dictated to the parties. Reform Party is 49 seats short of a majority under the numbers I've just given you. So that would require a substantial number of the Conservative Party to break away and join after the election to support Nigel Farage as Prime Minister. What I think would happen after a general election on the Friday, Saturday and Sunday, there'll be frantic negotiations between the parties, because clearly Labour might be the biggest of the opposition parties, but not very big. And they would have to, I think, get into bed with the Liberal Democrats, do a deal with the Scottish Nationalists. They won't go into coalition with the Scottish Nationalists, they could agree a parliamentary programme for, say, 2.5 years.
I mean, Zach Polanski, for instance, who is quite popular with the Greens and has come up, but he's a sort of energetic version of what Corbyn didn't quite succeed in doing. He's come out sort of quite clearly saying that, you know, he would back Burnham. He's obviously, because he wants something less centre, more to the left. My feeling is that Starmer basically is solid enough, serious enough, that he's going to carry on and he's not going to go, he's not going to make it easy for anyone to push him out. They don't enjoy in the Labour Party the sort of flippancy of the Conservative 1922 committee, which, over the last few years has been busier than ever.
I think you're right. It is quite difficult to mount a challenge within the rules of the Labour Party, deep rules, many of them very complicated, and loaded against a challenge or challenger. So even if there are bad results in May local government elections, probably Starmer might survive. I'm not 100% certain. But what is highly unlikely is that Andy Burnham can get back into the House of Commons easily. There has to be a vacancy. He has to be selected by the local association, and the electorate don't like being taken for granted. So even if the Labour Party find a safe seat, and Byrne was able to get a nomination there, it doesn't mean to say that the electorate would wear it. At the present time, there aren't many safe seats.
I mean, in terms of the opposition, I mean, oppositions tend to have short memories and are now looking for cudgels to hit the Labour Party with, and the current one at the moment has been the whole debate around the Chagos Islands, which is complicated. But I was going to ask you, the process that we saw in the last few days where the Lords, in a sense, was playing around with the whole debate, several amendments. I mean, Arlene Foster put one forward that didn't quite make it. I think she was 10 votes short of getting a referendum before anything's done. The message has come from the British government minister, look, you can't do anything that's going to change the deal. The deal is done and it's going ahead. We can talk about things, what we can do with the Chagosians and help them. And in the heart of that is the self-determination argument. They've been trying to pull Gibraltar into that argument for a very long time, because again, they would love to have Gibraltar. Two things. One, what is this ping pong system? Will it actually deviate the bill? And the second question I'd have is, this is the sort of part of the debate that could come up when the Treaty on Gibraltar comes up. In other words, when the treaty is there. So how much is this a sort of area where we have to be ready for some elements in the right, with influence in the Lords particularly, if not lower down, trying to stymie the deal or create problems for us? I mean, is that a possible scenario?
Well, I'm a split personality when it comes to the House of Lords. I mean, its constitution, its makeup is indefensible, but its function is extremely important, and particularly from a point of view of democratic examination of legislation and the performance and conduct of ministries, which do not tell the people or Parliament what they intended to do. The Chagos settlement or sellout was never put or voted upon by Parliament. It was never given thorough examination, as it would do in the United States of America. So I'm not, you know, they have proper examination of policy changes and things which relate to individual rights. We only have the House of Lords, who can be a nuisance to a government which has a massive majority, and I welcome their thorough examination of things relating to Chagos and the implications it could have for other territories of the United Kingdom. In relation to European Union and Gibraltar, I'm confident that although there are some Brexiteers in the ranks of the House of Lords, the overwhelming majority of them are on planet Earth, and you know, realise that the treaty, as we understand it, is a great step forward for Gibraltar and for the United Kingdom in association with Europe. I was just going to say that you ask about the conduct of things in the House of Lords, their behaviour. A controversial area which we might talk about on another occasion is the assisted dying bill. And they're going to fight that. It seems there's a built-in majority. To summarise, I welcome the House of Lords being a nuisance to a government, whether it's Labour or Tory, because it fulfils a function which is not adequately met by a supine House of Commons following either Labour or Tory majority.
And I mean, just finishing on that one, I mean, Arlene Foster, who you know, has spoken quite openly about it and says, look, they have the self-determination rights. And she's part of this Friends of the Overseas Territories group, FOTBOT, I think. But this is not an overseas territory. Chagos is not an overseas territory. So there's almost a movement coming out from there to recognise the Chagosians and Chagos as an overseas territory. which seems to me highly complex, given that no one's going to move the base away from there. People have been away from it. I mean, it's a terrible story, but people have been away from it for a very long time. I mean, what do you think the motive can be for trying to move that now? I mean, all these politicians have been there for a very long time, and so has the Shagall situation.
Yes, sadly, I'm very pessimistic about getting some justice for the Chagossians. The fact is that this goes back to the time of Harold Wilson's government, which I was very proud of. I thought it was very good overall, but this is one of their regrettable and shameful moves and actions when Dennis Healey was Defence Secretary. So we're going back a lot of time, and to remedy that I find extremely difficult. It has to be, I think, some crude monetary compensation, but a return is really not realistic, I'm afraid. I feel defeated on that. It should have been for people left, right and centre to have stood up and said that we will not stand for the arbitrary removal of people from their homelands back in the 1960s and 70s. We failed them. We failed them.
Well, on that note, we'll take a short break. You're listening to the podcast A Hard Place, and I'm Dominic Searle. If you have any questions or short comments, please send them to listengibraltar@outlook.com. That's one word, all lowercase, listengibraltar@outlook.com. Or just search out my name on Substack and message me.
Dominic, we're now back after a break there. I very much welcome being updated on two things. One is the McGrail inquiry and everything which that involves, which is, I know, very complicated, to say the least, to understand the issues. And the second one is an update on the treaty, which certainly I welcome, along with many other people, both in the ROC and in the United Kingdom, on Europe, Gibraltar and the United Kingdom for some many months, well, now years.
Well, the treaty, in a sense, it's not linked at all to the McGrail inquiry, but politically, it's clearly seen by the Chief Minister, who has given his New Year message already, and you know, it's clearly pushing the line. Look, I'm good. You know, this is my last full year, he said. He has wants to get Gibraltar at the end of the line on the treaty, i.e., signed up and so forth. We expect in the coming weeks that the translations, all the legal work on the treaty will be done. And that will then start the process, which is why I was asking you about the House of Lords, where it goes through, one, before the Gibraltar Parliament, so it needs the support of the Parliament. Now, in Gibraltar, basically, as long as all the government ministers toe the line, it's passed. Doesn't matter what the opposition says in terms of passing it. Obviously, ideally, people in Gibraltar, I think, would want a unanimous support for it from the House, because it gives them the confidence of where we're going.
Of course.
Then it needs to go also before the commissioners of the European Union, but not the individual parliament, so it goes to the Council. It needs the consent of the European Parliament, and it goes before the UK Parliament. It's there for 21 days. I think it will get picked up. I can't see them just ignoring it. So it will be debated. People will want to have a say on it. It's quite clear that there have been indications of interest in the treaty and where it's going. And obviously Farage may come out, you know, having his own statements on it. Anything to hit the Labour government may come out. So I don't think it's that people are against the treaty or against us, but I think it is a possible cudgel for some people. I think we'll get through that process. And then, you know, once that's sort of signed up and everybody's happy, the practical process has to unfold, which will take its time, training people, infrastructural things, creating committees that have agreements and how to handle things and so forth. So all that needs to happen. So But I mean, it's not on a negative roll. I mean, so I think what the problems of the McGrail inquiry, you know, which has been, I mean, I described it in a piece I did for the Chronicle as a self-inflicted colonialoscopy. I mean, I really think it was a waste of money. I don't think we needed that level of scrutiny to know that they didn't handle the departure of the commissioner well, technically. They didn't follow the procedures that should have been followed, none of which absolves anyone from the overall criticisms that that Openshaw has made about the way in which we conduct our business, the lack of note-taking, the seriousness of, getting involved in criminal cases when you shouldn't get involved with them or influencing them and so forth. But I think the Chief Minister clearly feels that he can see through on the basis that he's already said he's leaving. I think he feels confident that he can take people through to see the end of the treaty, which is a big political prize. I don't think it's going to absolve him politically totally, because the last election actually was lost by the opposition, who screwed up on their decision making. They got a candidate in who had a background of saying things on social media, very nasty things related to Jewish population and so forth. So that's not going to be something that's easily forgotten, and that's, you know, so there's an element of space at the moment in Gibraltar in the politics where no one's particularly happy with anybody, and therefore, you know, I think it will take a little bit of time for people to get confidence in politics in a solid way. But, you know, Fabien Picard has said he's going, so, and he will go. And I think it's a question of whether the current government can rebrand itself sufficiently to take on an election or not, and whether the opposition can really build itself to look fresher than it does, because it doesn't look very fresh at the moment. You don't get the feeling that if they walked in tomorrow, they've got a big plan to do all sorts of things. I mean, they're criticising the current government strongly and, with, you know, in some cases with plenty of fuel. But it's a very difficult political situation here, I think, at the moment, although people are not feeling it because they've just come out of Christmas.
Yes, but I think for friends, and I include myself amongst those, we'll find it a very interesting and historic political environment for the next year or two in Gibraltar. Certainly, there have been mistakes made in relation to the administration and the relationship between the government and the police commissioner and the police authorities. But putting that aside for a moment, I think that Fabien Picardo is entitled to great rewards in terms of his record in relation to the European Union Treaty, which I look forward to its formal ratification. It has an importance for the people of Gibraltar, but also for the United Kingdom. And it has only been achieved by a disciplined and tremendous amount of work by Chief Minister and his colleagues and the British Foreign Office.
But I think, you know, no one forced anyone to hold this the inquiry, and the problem with the inquiry, what it's exposed, I think, is to a great extent, you've had a major political issue. Let's not forget there was COVID in the middle, but the whole Brexit issue has been huge, and people have been giving it a lot of time. Of course, it's taken much longer than it should have. Everything has. From our point of view, Brexit should never have happened. But I think, you know, what the incident shows is actually it reflects someone who is pushed to the limit on bigger issues, suddenly finds that, you know, there's this whole hoo-ha around a very serious incident at sea, alleged smugglers killed in a fast launch incident by a collision with a police boat. It's now been established that it was an accident, but with a lot of caveats about training and procedure. So you lose your rag. You can't afford to lose your rag. You're the Chief Minister. So at the end of the day, The whole situation was unnecessary. Yes. And it's happened because people have not followed a steady, normal administrative course in all the little things that build up to having an incident. In other words, very few major incidents are the result of one thing. A meteorite might be one thing, but yes. Normally in other cases, there's a whole series of things that go wrong because checks aren't made on certain things, but people don't follow the procedure of taking the notes, there's not proper records, there's not formalities in the way you're doing things. And you get a major incident, and then you're not really ready for it. And I think,
I think the people of Gibraltar can and should take some justifiable pride in the fact that they replicate what are United Kingdom ministries and the scope of the Governor of Gibraltar and the Parliament is so wide and big. And the rest of the public service, similarly, you're numerically a small jurisdiction, and yet you maintain assiduously the rule of law, the consequences, and probably the irritation of a costly inquiry. But there's been a degree of openness, which is far superior to some of the places in Western Europe.
I would have said the lesson learned, if you're going to learn a lesson, although I think that some areas they've turned that phrase, it's not quite lesson learned, it's lessons noted, or, you know. But I mean, I think actually what you want to do there is recognise that Gibraltar needs to have a way of working which relates to the reality of our size. It's impossible not to know lots of people down the line. You've probably been to school with half of them. You can't run away from the fact that it'd be a very complicated situation to try and find people who've never seen each other or never talked to each other or whatever it is before. So you need to follow procedures, but I think you need to have procedures that work for a small place. And, you know, let's not kid ourselves. They don't work that well in the UK anyway. How many Met chiefs have had to, you know, are either under pressure or have to go? I mean, there's things happening in places all the time. When you're small and as you say, very successful, I mean, almost overachieving for our size.
You still use the word justifiable pride.
The answer? Do you have a parliament five times the size, so you have backbenchers and that, and we can't afford that? I mean, it may be that, you know, we've got the system we have, no one's going to change it overnight, but the reality is maybe it wasn't the best system to have for a place our size. But to have all this sort of constant politicking and press releases and battles all the time, when the solutions are going to be the same one. You need to fix the pavement, you need to have support for disabled people, all those things they're not going to change because you've had months and months of expensive rows.
No, well, I agree with, I think, almost all of what you said. And I think you have to be realistic. Small jurisdiction, you're going to be meeting your cousins or your friends who were school with all the time, and they are very good, enduring relationships, but it presents some problem in a small jurisdiction. And that's why I said that the people can be justifiably proud in what they've achieved. I think that constitutions need to be reviewed frequently. By frequently, I mean every sort of decade. And I think, as an observer and friend, I think there is a case for a slightly bigger legislature. The Parliament of Gibraltar is 17, I think. And I think under the Constitution, they could go up to 24. I think there is a case for that. But that wouldn't necessarily have avoided
If you create a situation in Gibraltar, I mean, you've got the leader of the opposition, and it's fair political game, has been banging away on social media, on X and so forth, saying, calling for resignation of the chief minister and everything else. That all sounds great, but, you know, just on a practical sense, if there's only one pilot in the plane at the moment, I mean, there might be two later on, or there might be a different one, but right now You know, Jib is not like in the UK, where if you have a situation and the Prime Minister, as happened with Boris Johnson, you know, the moment there's a weakness in the Prime Minister, there's loads of contenders to take over the job. And, you know, the underlying thing here, I think, is also the question of civil service. The civil service needs to have and take more responsibility in order to allow the continuity and avoid these situations. Because civil servants do have the power to stop a minister and say, "Minister, you can't do this. This is not appropriate meeting," or whatever it is. It's not, you know, you can't just behave like a tribe and then dress yourself as a parliament or as a parliamentary body. You've got to follow the difficult, awkward rules. It's like in a hospital, people might not like washing their hands every 5 minutes, but you've just got to do it.
Well, I think that there's been a lesson for lots of people, lots of agencies, as a result of the McGrail inquiry. It was disproportionately costly, arguably, but I think nevertheless, one can be satisfied that there's been a thorough airing. And an acknowledgement that mistakes were made by, say, both individuals and agencies. But what emerges is still a transparent and thorough democracy.
Well, we'll see what happens, because I understand that, you know, one of the leading lawyers in the case has been writing to ministers and MPs in the UK, pressing for action. And there was a law podcast by Adam Wagner, who was one of the lawyers for McGrail, which seemed to me pretty one-sided. I mean, you know, there were certain gaps in the questions about the McGrail inquiry, because the McGrail inquiry doesn't make anyone look good. All these people who came out saying, you know, from the chief minister across to McGrail, you know, vindicator and exonerator, no. The whole thing makes everybody look bad, basically, at different levels and different degrees, and still leaves, because it's so vast, you know, a lot to be debated. The curious thing about the whole inquiry is, for all the dramatic statements, the advice and the recommendations are actually unusually things that should be able to be done very, very quickly. Yeah. Now, the Chief Minister has said it's all going to be done by the summer, largely, and most of some are already in place. But these are things that, you know, were obvious before. You know, I go back to the washing of hands. You know, there are some things that you don't need someone to say, actually, this way is the way to do it, because you could avoid that. Some things that just should have been obvious. And I think what we need to learn is to do the obvious and then, you know, try and improve on all that.
I think that is a good summary and wind up.
Yes, on that note, I think we should say Happy New Year, and let's join the James Wood Trio.